So we are holding on Nun Tes Amud Aleph by the Mishnah, and we're going to be beginning a new topic, which is, we've been spending the whole perek, the last 17 blocks, talking about the various cases where an animal becomes trefa because of some kind of organic, because of some kind of disease or some kind of accident or predator or what have you. Now we got to talk about, okay, well, which animals are you allowed to eat and not eat, are you allowed and not allowed to eat in the first place? What are the simonim of them? And by the way, so it's true, but I think it's the same principles a lot of times. I've mentioned before, a lot of times you find mesechtes that begin with less common cases and then move to the more common cases. I think it's because, look, I mean, we know originally Torah Baal Peh was supposed to be Baal Peh. It wasn't supposed to be written down. Right. They had to write it down because they're concerned that they have to first compose it in words and later on write it down because they're concerned people are going to forget it. So it may make sense. They may have started first with the less obvious things that are more likely to be forgotten, and only then later on had to eventually, when they're adding to it and making it into the Mishnayos and that we have in front of us, then they're going to add the more obvious things that up until then they were still able to keep by heart and without any fixed wording, but now they need to be written down for posterity.
Do we know anything about the compilation process? Like, did Rebbe have a bunch of manuscripts? Do you have a team?
So it's actually... There are actually a lot of different opinions about it. Among other things, you have the basic question whether Rebbe wrote Mishnayos or whether he only fixed the text but kept it oral. That's Rashi versus Rambam, for example, about that. But other than that, I mean, basically what it seems is that Rebbe took all the various versions of the Mishnayos that were around in his time and collated them together. For the most part, he used Reb Meir's wording, which is why we say Sam Mishnah Reb Meir, because Reb Meir's was the most concise and the most clear and everything. Reb Meir was a generation before Rebbe. So mostly he used Reb Meir's text of the Mishnayos, but he would collate together like what the different opinions are, and then make a Stam Mishnah according to the majority, for example, things like that.
And no one had done that before him.
No, before Rebbe. So you had every Talmid Chacham, every Rebbe taught his Talmidim using his own wording. That sometimes it would be wording that he learned from his Rebbeim, sometimes it would be wording that he made ad hoc for the situation. But yeah, so therefore
he wrote it down.
So that's the thing. The Rambam holds that Rebbe actually wrote down the Mishnah. Not necessarily. Rashi learns that he made a fixed text of it, where up until then, again, every Rebbe had every teacher had their own way of wording it. But so what Rebbe did is he made one fixed text that everybody should use. But according to Rashi, it was still continued to be oral. It seems. I mean, it seems very hard. But they had bigger brains. I mean, they had more of a capacity for memorization then, you know. And Lahavdil nowadays also, you can see, you know, you have people who, when they have the ability to, they know a lot. The more people rely on Rabbi Google or whatever, the less they know for themselves, because the point is, because you could write it, you could make an oral text from now on, the text for this halacha is going to be such and such, for example. It's okay. And you have Gemaras where it seems they weren't sure about details of the wording, where if it had been in manuscript, they could have just checked the manuscript. So that seems to sort of more bear out Rashi's, version of things. But you have a huge amount of ink that's spilled on all the
documents.
No, there's no actual manuscript. No, the earliest manuscript, the earliest writing of Torah Shabbat Peh that we find is actually a mosaic floor that they found of a shul someplace in Eretz Yisrael, where they have a mosaic that lists certain halachas about Shemitah or about other mitzvot atloyes baris that the people needed to know, and so they made the mosaic of those. No, so it's similar to the piece of town. There's a piece in Gemara Yerushalmi and Bechorim in Bikurim or something that resembles that, so it may be based on the same source text. But yeah, but no, the earliest manuscripts the earliest actual manuscripts of paper or papyrus or parchment or whatever are from like the 7th, 8th, 9th century.
Way, way up.
All right, so let's get started over here. So we have to talk about about how do we know whether a particular life form is kosher or not. And by the way, you have an interesting discussion that a lot of Rishonim have. These various simonim that we're going to be talking about, are they, there's two ways of looking at them. You can look at it, for example, that let's say, for example, a cow is kosher, a horse is not. So we know a cow chews its cud and has split hooves, a horse has neither. Is it that that Hashem decided for reasons of his own that the cow should be kosher and the horse should not? And therefore, in order for us to be able to tell, Hashem gave us certain signs, but the signs don't make the animal kosher or not. The animal is intrinsically kosher or intrinsically not kosher, and Hashem gave it, Hashem provided it with certain physical characteristics that we can use to figure it out. Or is it that those physical characteristics actually make it kosher or not? The number of places, the Rogachover, for example, writes that the Rambam's opinion, the way the Rambam phrases it, seems to be the second one, that the physical characteristics actually make it kosher or not kosher, as the case may be. And the Rebbe refers to that in a number of places in Sichas, and then relates it to other things, and then it relates it to other things in Torah. Simone Behem.
It could have been kosher. We could have had, you know, all the animals stated whether they're kosher or not.
Right. So actually with birds, we have a list of non-kosher birds. I think if I remember correctly, what it is the Rogachover distinguishes. He says the simonim that we're going to discuss over here about animals, kosher or not, make them kosher, as opposed to the simonim that we're going to talk about of birds and of locusts are not what make them kosher. They're just things for us to be able to determine. Right. Okay. So simonim behem of chayin nemru min haTorah. Hello. Simonim of kosher and non-kosher land animals are given in the Torah. The simoni ha'oflei nemru, the ones of birds, are not explicitly given in the Torah. The Torah gives us a list of a bunch of non-kosher birds, 24, as we're going to say in the Gemara, in a few blanks, but it doesn't actually say what makes one bird kosher and what tells us that one bird is kosher and one is not. Avol amru chachamim, but the chachamim said there are simonim for birds, like this. Number one, kol oif ha-doreis tomei. Any bird that is doreis is tomei. It is not kosher. What does doreis mean? We have a number of different opinions among the rishonim. So we actually had, last week we talked about, a few blocks back, we had the concept of drisa, one of the eight basic types of treifus, where we said over there that you have a predatory animal or bird, sticks its claws or its talons or whatever into the victim and injects some kind of venom or whatever. So you have rishonim who learn that that's what it means over here, that we're talking about birds that do the same kind of thing. They stick their claws into their prey and inject this kind of venom. Many of the other Rishonim say that no, that's not what it means. It means that it means something else that they do with their talons, with the fingers or whatever, with the things on the end of their legs, whatever you want to call them, talons or nails or whatever. Rashi says that it's what it is we're talking about dirtus means that the bird picks up the food from its ground with its nails.
Right.
So Tosfos later on asks on that. You have Tosfos that are printed later on, Daf Samach Aleph, that actually belong to our Mishnah, where Tosfos says that can't be that. Chickens do the same thing. Chickens are definitely kosher. So you can't say that that's what dirt means. So to take food from the ground and pick it up with their claws. Sometimes they pick it up with their beaks, but sometimes they also pick it up with their. Sometimes they also. Tosfos says, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. So anyway, so Tosfos over there explains, Rabbi Natan says that dirtus means a bird that eats its prey while it's still alive.
Who said that?
That's Tosfos. Rabbi Natan says that over there. So again, we have so far three possibilities. Dirtus means that it injects venom.
Right.
Rashi says that dirtus means that it picks things up from the ground with its claws. And Tosfos says, Rabbi Natan says that it means that it eats prey while it's alive. And you have other explanations. There's another explanation that somebody's shown him say that dirtus means that the bird uses its claws or whatever you want to call them to hold down its food while it's eating it. Okay. Anyway, so any bird that is dirtus is tummy. Kol shiyesh lei etzba yisera. Now, any bird that has an extra toe.
When he holds his food, mean on a regular basis, not one time.
Yeah, right? I guess. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that. Kol shiyesh lei etzba yisera, then you have like this, any bird that has an etzba yisera, which the etzba yisera literally means an extra toe, literally means an extra toe, but again, there's a few explanations in Rishonim what we mean by an extra toe. It doesn't seem to have good pictures of it over here, but One possibility, so there's a couple of possibilities here. Actually, it has here, actually, you have pictures. One possibility is that it means many birds have, like this, you have along the leg, you have the bottom of the leg, you have three toes, but then further up, you have another toe halfway down the leg, halfway down the lower part of the sort of like a thumb, I guess, in that sense. So Rashi says that that's the Esbi Yaseira. You have other Rishonim who learn that Esbi Yaseira doesn't mean necessarily an extra toe like that. It means that the middle toe, the three toes, is longer than the other one. The Ramban, for example, holds that way. Okay. And number one, so Esbi Yaseira, the Zefek, and number two, that the bird has a crop, which we learned about a couple of days ago, which is a pouch in along the esophagus where food is stored temporarily while the first stage of digestion. The Kokuvone Niklof, and its gizzard, which is stomach, can be peeled. The stomach of a bird, we learned earlier in the parak, has two layers. It has a muscular layer, and it has an inner layer that actually grinds up the food. And though in a kosher bird, or in summer, all kosher birds, as we're going to see, then those two layers can be peeled off one from another. So those, tahar, so such birds are tahar. Now, Rashi later on in...
The Chachamim figured
these out. In fact, Tosfos actually asks later on that how Tosfos actually starts by asking the question later on. I mean, how did the Chachamim know that any? Well, in particular, Tosfos asked the question. I mean, were the Chachamim hunters or something? Did they check all kosher birds and found that no kosher bird is a predator? So Tosfos says that maybe what it is. The Torah lists a bunch of birds, but it doesn't say any physical characteristics of them. So if we're trying to figure out, we're saying that. Animals, the turtle said, Mephresis, Pyrus, and Maligera, that it chews its cud and has split oats. That's the same. By birds, all the turtle tells us, these are the birds. You shouldn't eat the Nesher and the Paris and the Osmia and so forth. And if you don't know what a Nesher and a Paris and Osmia are. So the Chachamim figure it out. So one second. So later on in the Gemara, we're going to see how the Chachamim derive these simanim. But anyway, Tosfos starts by saying that maybe what it is going back to when Noach brought Korbanos out after he came out of the Teva. So it says he brought from all the kosher animals and all the kosher birds. So he had all the birds and all the animals with him because they were all the ones that were going to survive the Mabul. There were two or seven of them with him, as the case may be. So he was able to check and found that all the kosher ones are not dirtless. And therefore, he passed on that information, and that is how the Chachamim have that particular bit of information that no kosher animal, that no kosher bird is dirtless. No, but the point is, the point is, he sees after they get out of the table, he's able to see that when they go back to their normal behavior. Okay, that's Tosfos gives that explanation. But anyway, going back to, so like, okay.
Can we say that whatever the Torah says,
that's fine, in principle, because the Chachamim need, because let's say we don't know what those birds are. Let's say we want to identify some other, let's say we find the particular bird. We don't know. Is it a Nesher? Is it a Peret? Is it an Osmia? Or is it any one of the other ones that are listed over there? So in principle, you can check using these simanim. So that's why the Chachamim gave us these simanim. Now, with that said, partly because the simanim themselves are not so clear. We just had as far as Zerdus, we have four different opinions what it means. As far as Esbi Yaseira, we had two different opinions. Because of that, as we're going to eventually say in the Gemara, really you can only eat an oif tahor only b'masodas. Only if you have a masoda on it, that is kosher, which is why we have that most birds nowadays we can't eat. Only when we have a masoda, so going back in January, which is, by the way, why you have the famous thing, are we allowed to eat turkey? Turkey is native to America. There was no Masoretis because there were no Jews in America before 1492. So you have Achronim, who in fact said there's no Masoretis on it, you can't eat it. Famously, the Shalah Kaddish said that, and he writes in Shalah that his descendants shouldn't eat turkey. I know people, Ada Yemazet, who are descended from the Shalah and won't eat turkey for that reason.
The majority
of people do, because what it is you have other considerations. You have Rabbanim who talked about that the turkey is related to certain other birds that were known in olden times that do have a Masoda, and therefore it's close enough to them that the Masoda for those covers it. There's also the fact that turkeys can interbreed with kosher birds and produce offspring, and the Gemara tells us elsewhere that kosher and non-kosher species can't interbreed, so you have considerations like that make it allowed. But for example, there are other examples. There's a bird. There's another kind of bird that's native to America. There's no turkey in Europe. But there was another bird that's native to America called a Muscovy duck. Why it's called Muscovy, which is like Moscow, when it's native to America, I haven't the slightest clue. But anyway, there was an argument about it in the 1800s whether it's kosher or not. And there, the conclusion was it's not because there's no Masoret on it. Okay.
Can you speculate as to why Torah provides Simanim for Bani Yisrael, but not
Good question. I don't know. Although I should mention, by the way, an interesting thing that it says that's brought from the Arizal. What's the Hebrew word for a bird? It's tzipor. If you take the second letter of each of these four, ofer is a more general term meaning anything that flies. Tzipor, in the last parak of our Masechta, we're going to talk about actually that tzipor more specifically means kosher birds.
In Torah,
you also have tzipor many times.
Many letters.
Called tzipor Torah to Chelu, but yeah. Anyway, the Arizal says like this: if you take these four simonim and you take the second letter of each one of them, then it spells out the word tzipor. S by Yisera, Zefek, not Doires, which is Esba, the Tzadik, Zefek is a Fei, same thing, Doires, second letter of it is Vav, and Kur Kivano Niklas. So the second letter of each one of those spells out Tzipor, and what we're saying, with Kuf, Vav, Kuf, Resh, Kuf, it could be spelled without the Vav. I mean, in the printed Mishnayos, in Gemara, it's usually written without the Kodesh, so you put in the Vav, or whatever. But anyway, a further nuance in that is three of these simonim are things we're saying the bird has to have. One of them, the dirtus, we're saying it's not supposed to have. That is why very often the word tzipor in the Torah is spelled without a vav, to indicate that the vav thing, the dirtus, should not be there, and the other three things, the esba and the zefek and the kork of a niklof, should be there. Okay. Anyway, returning to, okay, so that's a word from the Arizal. Okay.
Yeah. Always...
Okay, so now like this. Rashi explains like this. How do we just said that if the bird is not dirtus, and then we mentioned these three simonim. So Rashi learns like this. What it means is, in order for the bird to be tahor, number one, you have to have it's not dirtus, and number two, you also have to have the other three simonim to know that it's tahor. Otherwise you can't be sure unless you can identify it. Tosfos again later on Samach Aleph, where they have all the Tosfos that belong on this Mishnah, says that no, that's not what it means. What it means is like this: any bird. What Tosfos says, Rabbeinu Tam says, what it means is if you have a bird that has these other three simonim, that has the Etz Yisera and the Zefek and Kukuvan and Niklof, automatically you know it's not a Jewess, it's not a Dirtus. So Rashi would be saying you have to check whether it's a dirtus, and then on top of that, once you find it's not, you have to check for the other three simonim. Rabbeinu Tam says what it means is if it has the other three, automatically you know it's not dirtus. I don't know what the Rambam. I believe that Rambam Paskin is more like Rashi, but I'm not sure. Okay.
You need to
know that you need all four things. Yeah. Okay. Continue the Mishnah. Rabbi Lozib Rabbi Sodikim, Kol Oif Acholik Asrag Lov Tomei. Any bird that divides its feet is Tomei. In other words, you have certain kinds of birds where when they perch, parrots are like that, for example, when they perch on a branch or whatever, they have two toes in front of it and two toes behind it. So the Rabbi Lozib Sotik is telling us a bird that sits that way, that perches that way, you know for a fact that it's a dirtus.
And a kosher would be three.
A kosher would be three and one, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Uva Chagovim.
The predators use three and one, I think.
No, not necessarily. No, and the predators, for the most part, use two and two. Okay. Over Chagovim, now, so that's as far as birds. What about as far as locusts? Now, the Torah tells us that there are four, or as we'll see in the Gemara, really eight types of locusts that are mutter. The Lamaista, we don't eat any of them because we don't have a Masorah on them. So in Yemen, the Jews of Yemen do eat locusts. I had my wife many years ago had a Yemenite coworker where her mother, who still lives in Yemen, used to every so often send her packages of kosher grasshoppers to eat. Yeah, and the Yemenites... And that's okay. It's not for any time during the year. But, yeah. So the Yemenites have a Masorah. I didn't say my mother. Her mother-in-law, my wife's co-worker's mother, when my wife's co-worker's mother would send her locusts every so often to eat. Okay. Anyway. So the Temanim have a Masorah, so they're able to eat locusts. Ashkenazim don't, and Sfardim don't either. There is an interesting thing in that regard, actually. The Ur Chaim HaKadosh writes, and one of his name writes that he lived in Morocco most of his life. The Ur Chaim, yeah. And the Jews of Morocco also used to eat locusts. But he finally was able to convince them not to, because the fact of the matter is, you know, we can't really be certain about the Masorah. So eventually he got them to stop, and he writes, it's been 12 years since they all accepted to not, and ever since then there has never been a locust, there's never been a locust infestation in Morocco, even though up until that point they used to suffer from them very often. Yeah. Okay.
How long ago did Erich Chaim
live? He lived in the 1700s, he was nicked in 1743, Tavkuf Gimel. Okay. Over Chagovim, what are the simonim of kosher locusts? If it had any species of locust that has four regular legs, now locusts are insects, they have six legs, but what we mean is four of them are regular legs that it uses for walking. The arba knafayim, and that it has four wings.
It's a bug.
That's the point. Because the Torah tells us that chagavim you're allowed to eat. They're the only type of insects that you're allowed to eat. Yes, that's false success. We'll say in parashas, kol sheretz ha'oif, you're not allowed to eat. Achas zet ha'ichlu, mikol sheretz ha'oif, ahoy lachalaga, asher lo yikra ayin mimal l'raglov, asay lo mehem techeilu, asa arbe l'mine, asa solom, yeah.
But not every species of locust.
That's the point. So how do we know which ones?
We're talking about birds and behemoths.
Now we're shifting and talking about locusts. Because you have four different... Okay, you have to realize... One thing you have to realize is... This will be useful when we go throughout this Mishnah and the Sugyas and the next few Daphim or whatever. You have to realize the Torah classifies life forms a little differently than we would nowadays. Like, now, for example, what is a bat? A bat's a mammal. So you wouldn't consider it a bird, but the Torah lists it in the list of non-kosher birds. What is a whale? Also, that's not the point. The point is, well, okay. I'm sure in some places they eat them, but whatever. The point is, the Torah doesn't classify life forms by, like, you know, if mammals are, you know, they nurse their young, they give birth to live young, etc. The Torah basically classifies creatures by how they move around. So you have land animals, behemoths and chayas, where you can they have legs, they have visible legs, and you can see them walking. Within that, okay, you have behemoths that are domesticated and chayas that are wild. You have anything that flies is under the category of oif, whether it's a bird or whether it's a mammal like a bat. Within that, you have sheretz oif, which are flying insects like grasshoppers and like flies and mosquitoes and whatnot. Then you have shrutim, which are also land animals, but they're ones that have short legs. So Rashi mentioned in a number of places, not like locusts. No, locusts
they're
is...
not considered shrutim?
Locusts are not shrutim. Shrutim are, for example, you have the Shemona shrutim that the Torah mentions, for example. Again, we're not quite certain of the identity of many of them, but it seems that they include things like turtles and toads and certain kinds of lizards and whatever. They have legs, but they move around, but they have very short legs. So Rashi mentions in a number of places that the word sheretz means something that it looks like it's just like crawling or scurrying around. Those are a category of their own.
So their body cannot really leave the ground.
Pretty much, yeah. Like their body is very, very close to the ground.
Very, very close.
Right. So those are a category called shrutim.
Oh.
And then you have, yeah. And then, yeah. So that's, and then you have anything that lives in the water is called a fish. Again, whether it's an actual fish or whether it's a mosquito, you share a toy.
It's not
crawling. No, but it's sheretz ha'oif. It's a small flying creature. When it's on the ground, its body is close to the ground. And when it's flying, it flies. Yeah, but when it's flying, it flies. So it's called sheretz ha'oif as opposed to larger birds, which are. All right. Anyway, so uba chagovim, when it comes to locusts, how do you tell which ones are kosher? Kol sheyesh le'arba raglayim, the ones that have four regular legs for walking. The arba knafayim, four wings. The kartsulim. And it has two jumping legs. You can see in the pictures over here, for example, that you have, let's say, with these, not necessarily are these kosher locusts per se, but the point is that the point is they have these legs that stick out above the body that it uses specifically for jumping. Yeah. That's the kartsulim. That's the word. Kartsul, I don't know what language it's from. Literally, kartsul means a leg. So it means specialized leg like that. Uknafav choifenes ruba, and it also has to be that the wings cover the majority of its body.
So they can leap and fly.
Yeah. Rabbi Yossi Omer Ushmai Chagav. Rabbi Yossi says there's another criteria. They have to actually be called Chagav. They have to be called by the name Chagav. In other words, they have to be in subspecies of the type that are called Chagav. And since we don't know what those are, that's why we don't have a Masorah on them. The Yemenites, actually, it's interesting. Part of their Masorah is that the ones that are kosher have a little marking on the bottom of their abdomen that looks like a letter Ches standing for Chagav.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, that's it. Okay.
These creatures that are
chayfam. They're not a literal chet, but they have a little natural marking on the. Okay. Uva dogim. What about when it comes to fish? The rule is kol sheyesh le'snapi v'kapkeset. Yeah, anything that has fins and scales. Sorry about this. Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Rabbi Yehuda says it has to be at least shnei kaskasin snapper echad. It's not just enough to have one scale. You have to have two scales at least, and you have to have at least one fin. The Elo and Kaskasin are going by. So what are Kaskasin? They're the ones that are attached to its body, namely the scales. not literally attached, as in they can't be detached. That would actually be not kosher scales. It means they're attached. They don't move around, but they can actually be peeled off. They can be peeled or otherwise removed without breaking the skin. That's why, for example, you have, let's say, sharks have a kind of scales on the on their skin, but they're not kosher because their scales are not removable without tearing the skin.
So the scales have to be removable.
Salmon, they're removable. All the kosher fish, they're removable. With snapirim, apireachbehem, the definition of snapir is the things that the fish uses to swim with, namely its fins. Okay. Sigmar says.
There are fish with scales that are not removable?
That means that you have ones where the scales are basically, I mean, scientists may call them scales, but they're basically projections of the skin rather than something else. That's like on top of the skin, kind of.
Feathers, you can remove them.
Right, exactly. So kosher fish's scales are more like feathers. They're removable without breaking the skin, in that sense.
Whereas
non-kosher fish's scales are the type of scales that are actually part of the skin. They're like outgrowths of it, right.
More like an internal organ.
Not so much like an internal organ, but just like you have, like you'll have bumps or whatever on the skin, but they're an actual part of the skin, and if you try to remove them, you'll tear the skin.
Like, for example, that whale with the blowhole.
So whales don't have scales of fowl.
But I mean, like, it's a mechanism like that.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be
whales are mammals, but in Torah terminology, they're considered fish because they live in the water. In order to be kosher, they'd have to have fins and scales. Fins they have, that's flippers, but scales they don't have, so they... The Mishnah mentions elsewhere, by the way, that a general rule, I think we actually had it earlier in our Masechta, any fish that has scales, you know automatically it has fins. But the reverse is not true. You have water creatures that have fins and don't have scales. Sharks, catfish, lots of others. Okay, so the most starts off. Tana Rabbanan. Elohim simonim behema. What are the simonim of kosher land animals? So like this, as the pasuk says, kol mafres, kol behema, mafres is karis. We're going to any animal that has split hooves and chews its cud. So the braisa says like this, kol behema shemalach gera, any creature, any animal that chews its cud, biadua she'en l'shinayim l'mayla, then automatically you know that it doesn't have any teeth on its upper front jaw. So meaning, in other words, like this. With a kosher animal, so like this, for example, here's a picture of the mouth of a cow. It has teeth on the bottom jaw in the front. So like this, think of a human being. A human being has teeth in the front, in the middle, and the back. They have chewing teeth, they have canines, they have molars or whatever. Kosher...
No, we're not kosher.
Right. Kosher animals, kosher land animals... Kosher land animals, kosher land animals have molars on the top and bottom and in the front and in the back. They have chewing teeth in the front on the bottom, but on the top they don't have chewing teeth or canines. Where they have kind of a pad there that the bottom teeth press up against that pad. That's actually the point. Therefore, those animals can't fully digest can't fully chew their food. That's why they need to chew their cud. That's why it needs to come up again for them to re-chew it in order to be able to get all the nutrients out of it. Right. So what it is they chew it as much as possible with these front teeth. They bite from it and they chew it as much as possible with these front teeth and with their molars and whatever, and with this pad, but it's not fully chewed up. That's why it needs to go through the whole process of regurgitation in order for them to get enough nutrients out of it. As opposed to, for example,
there's a cow over there?
So there's the cow.
Oh, that's
there's the cow. So it has teeth in the front, but not on the bottom, but not the top. So the braisa is telling us any animal that chews its cud, they don't have front teeth on top, right? So therefore,
because they eat grass.
So any behemoth that's malagera that chews its cud, be a dua she'en l'shinayim l'mayla, automatically you know that it does not have upper teeth in front, or tahara, and therefore it's troublesome. We ask the klalahu, is that a general rule? There are exceptions there. Vare gomel de malagera, what about a camel? A camel, the Torah tells us, chews its cud also. And the Enlo Shinaim Lamaila, it also doesn't have upper teeth, the tome, and yet a camel is tome. So it's not true that you can't say that every animal that chews its cud doesn't have upper front teeth and it's kosher, because what would you do with a camel? The answer is, Gomel Nivi Islay. The answer is that a camel is different because it doesn't have incisor teeth in front, that's true, but it does have Nivi. Now, what are nivi? You actually have two explanations of what it means. One is that it means these teeth over here, canine teeth, sort of, right? I don't know if actual canines, because canines are really for meat eaters and camels aren't meat eaters, but whatever, some kind of tooth over there. It's not an incisor. It's not in front. You wouldn't use it to bite off things, to cut off things, but you would use it as part of the chewing process. So one possibility is that it means that camels have that. The other possibility, it actually says, is that nibi means not an actual tooth, but a projection, a bump on the gum that sort of performs kind of the function of a tooth in that sense. Okay, whatever it is, the camels have those, unlike, for example, cows and other kosher animals that have no such things at all. Okay, the question is about a Bengal.
Because they have that,
then it doesn't violate the rule that we said. So we have, they do chew their cud, but they also have upper teeth. Therefore, they're not kosher.
These are called teeth?
Those are called teeth, yeah.
The nibi,
yeah. Okay, so what?
They're either bumps?
They're either bumps or actual teeth. Yeah, okay. Okay, what about a Ben Gomel, the nibi namilas? Okay, what about a young camel, though? A young camel hasn't developed those teeth yet.
Well, no, that's...
No, but the fact of the matter is, if we're saying a general rule, any animal that doesn't chew its cud... The two, and besides that... No, but why would the Braita be telling us unless we need to know it for practical purposes? The two, and besides that, what about Bahare Shofan Bahar Neves? What about... You have another exception to the rule. You have... The Braita is telling us any animal that chews its cud, you know automatically it doesn't have upper front teeth, but... Aside from the camel that we just talked about, you also have the Shofan and the Arnevis, which are two other creatures that the Torah mentions that chew their cud and don't have split hooves. Demalaskerahin, they do chew their cud. They do regurgitate in some sense. We'll talk about it in a second house, though. The Yeshlahen Shinaim Lamaila, they have upper front teeth, or Tmein, and they are Tamei. Besides which, anyway, what's the point of the Braita? What do we care whether the animal has upper teeth? The important point you want to know is whether the animal is kosher. Whether it's kosher is whether it chews its cud and has split hooves. The teeth have nothing to do with it, per se. So why would the Braita be telling us that if the animal chews its cud, you know automatically it doesn't have upper front teeth? Why do we care if it has upper front teeth or not, as long as we know it chews its cud? Rather, we have to say what the Braita means is the other way around. The Braita got it backwards. Well, we're going to revise the Braita. Okay, come on. We're going to revise the Braita a bit. Kol behema, it's the other way around. Kol behema, she'em la, shenayim la maila, it's the other way around. If an animal does not have upper front teeth, b'yadua, she'emayla skedo, mafretas parasa, automatically then you know that it chews its cud and has split hooves, or tahoda, and therefore it's tahor. So that fits with what we just said. We said that a camel does have upper front teeth because it doesn't have the incisors, maybe, fine, but it has the nivi, which are also upper teeth. You have, in the case of the Shofan and the Arnevis, they have incisors as well. So therefore, the rule fits. So what are Shofan and Arnevis? Okay, so you have like this. The common translation of Shofan and Arnevis is the hare and the rabbit. So that's a possibility. The problem with that, there's a couple of problems with that. One of them being that you have psukim, for example, that describe the shofan, the bochinafshu, which we say every Rosh Chodesh, the sloy mas of a shvanim, that the rocks are a refuge for the shvanim, implying that the shofan lives among the rocks. Hares and rabbits don't really. So there's a number of problems with that. There are a number of people, it goes all the way back at least to Sadia Gaon, who say that the shofan is a little creature called a hyrax. It looks sort of like an overgrown hamster.
Yeah,
I can find a picture for you. But it looks sort of, it's not a hamster, but it looks sort of like an overgrown one. So it does live among the rocks, and it does fit a number of the other descriptions that we seem to have over here. So here's a picture of it. Here's a picture of it.
That's a hamster?
No, I didn't say it's a hamster. It's a hyrax. Some people say that that's the shofan. Okay, so you have some people say that. On the other hand, you have other difficulties with that also, including the fact the Torah tells us the shofan and the arnevis chew their cud, but neither hares nor rabbits nor hyraxes really chew their cud in the same way that cows and sheep and whatever do. So you have a few different possibilities that are brought up about it. First of all, one possibility is the Shofan and the Arnevis could be other creatures that we're not familiar with nowadays. They might even be ones that are extinct or whatever. Another possibility they talk about is that there's these creatures, hyraxes and hares and rabbits, they do redigest their food. Not in the same way as with kosher animals, where they have four stomachs and it goes down to the second stomach and then it gets regurgitated, et cetera, but they do have some sort of thing where they excrete their food not fully digested, and then they eat those pellets and redigest them again. So in a certain, plus also a lot of times they sit over there moving their mouth as if they were chewing their cuds. So for those reasons, those are possibilities why it's described as maligator. Anyway, but therefore, so once we change the Braisa's wording, then it works out. We're saying any animal that chews its cud, automatically we know that it doesn't have, or the other way around, if we see that it doesn't have upper teeth, automatically we know it chews its cud. And we also know, therefore, we haven't found any exception, right? We're going to say later, right? Okay. So the question is, why do you need to just do that? The Livdik Papyrus is there. What do you mean? You're telling me that once you see it doesn't have upper teeth, then automatically you know it chews its cud and that it has split hooves. Why do you need to know from that? Why do you need to look at the mouse to tell what the hooves look like? Look at the actual hooves and see whether they're split or not. So why should it be any easier to look at the mouse than it should be to look at the hooves? The answer is, Kugan Shayu Parasitseh Chachokos. Right, but what if you find an animal where the hooves have been cut off? Then you can't check them. So then you can know. Hold on. That's right. The chidur of chista. So therefore, this braisa is telling us what Rav Chista tells us, which is that what we're saying. Hoyim ahalach b'midbar. Rav Chista says, suppose a person is traveling in the desert. He finds an animal with its hooves chopped off. So how is he going to know whether it's kosher or not, so that he knows whether he can eat it or not? That's what the braisa is telling us. Bodik b'pia. You check its mouth. If you find that it doesn't have upper front teeth, then you know that it's a tahor species. Imlav, and if you find that it has upper front teeth, then automatically you know it's tameh. However, that only works if he can recognize that this mystery animal that he found is not a camel.
What is it talking about? Why did
he
find animal?
That's exactly that. A person is wandering in the desert. He needs something to eat. He needs food. No. It's only when he found a live animal. He found a live animal. He doesn't have right now he doesn't have food to feed it to see if it chews its cud. So therefore, a shortcut is check whether it has upper front teeth. If it doesn't, then and now its legs, let's say, have been chopped off, so you can't check the feet. So therefore, what you do is as well as that's the point. Once we see that it doesn't have upper front teeth, we know automatically that it has both simonim because we know for a fact that's what the braisa is telling us, and that's what Rav Chista is clarifying for us, that once that the chachamim knew and informed us that once you see it doesn't have upper front teeth, you know automatically therefore that it chews its cud. Now, we just said there's three animals the Torah tells us chew their cud and don't have split hooves and are not kosher. The gomel, the shofan, and the arnevet. So the gomel, so that's what we say, as long as you can recognize this isn't a gomel, then you don't have a problem. So 1 second, you're going to ask about the shofar and the arnevis. Hold on. So the one second. So the question is, gomel nivi islay, why should you have to be able to recognize it's not a camel? We just said before, gomel, a camel has nivi, so all you have to do is check if it has nivi or not. The answer is, ella overvachiaku ben gomel. Okay, what it means is, as long as you can recognize that this isn't a young camel, because a young camel doesn't yet have nivi, but it also doesn't have upper front teeth. So therefore, you would have to be able to recognize that this is not a ben gomel, and then you know you're good. Right. Now, why? What about, shouldn't you have to recognize that it's not also a shofan and an arnevis? So in fact, on the next piece of Gemara, Tosfos says, yeah, the same logic. In other words, when we say the gomel, we mean also you'd have to know it's not a shofan and an arnevis. You have other, and Sichas Kolon, he points out, maybe the Gemara didn't mention them because the Shofan and Arnevis are very distinctive. They look, they're smallish creatures. They look much different than kosher animals. It'll be easy to tell whether it's a Shofan and Arnevis. It might not be as easy to tell whether this unknown animal that you found is a camel. Okay, but the question is, Lav Amrit Ika Ben Gomel, you just said that there's an exception to the rule that a young camel doesn't have upper front teeth at all, and yet it's not kosher. Because it doesn't have split hooves. Ikanami midyachrin the dummy of the Ben Gomel. Why shouldn't you have to be concerned that maybe there's some other species out there that's like a young camel in that sense, not having upper front teeth and still not having split hooves? So how can you eat this animal, which has its hooves missing? The answer is loy sakadaita. Don't think that way. The Tony Dvei Rabbi Shmuel. that you're going to find such another species. The Tani Dvei Rabbi Shmuel, because in the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, they learned a braisa, that when the Pasuk says, Ve'efa gomol ki malageiru, the Pasuk says that the camel is malageira and not machus parsa, and as it chooses its cud but doesn't have split hooves, meaning, shalit ba'ilomo yodea, Hashem who rules the world, knows, she'en l'chadova malageira v'tomei elegomol, that there is no other species that is malageira but doesn't have split hooves aside from the camel. And as Tosis points out, also the shofar and the arneves, but okay, the shofar and the arneves, again, they don't really chew their cud, they just do some other kind of regurgitation, and they have upper front teeth anyway, they're visibly different. So therefore, the pichach porat by akos of hu. Therefore, the pasuk says, ki malageira hu, implying that the camel is the only exception. So therefore, that's what the braisa is telling us and Rav Chisda is telling us. As long as you can recognize that this unknown animal that you found with missing hooves, missing bottoms of its legs, and it doesn't have upper front teeth, as long as you can recognize it's not a ben gomel, then you're good.
What about a llama?
What about a llama? So there's a couple of possibilities. First of all, llamas, it turns out, they are somewhat similar to camels, and they've actually even bred them together. They could be, as far as Torah is concerned, they could be considered one species. But you have some people argue that maybe when the Gemara is saying over here, Shalat by Lama Yodea, what it means is in the area where Jews live for thousands of years, meaning basically you're talking the old world, you know, you're not talking in the Andes, then you have no other species other than these. It doesn't necessarily exclude the possibility that there are ones in other parts of the world, but again, the other possibility is that we could just say that llamas are considered, as far as Torah is concerned, just a subspecies of camel. Shalat is Hashem, who rules the world. He knows what's going on in it. Okay. I mean, you have a famous thing that people often bring up in this connection, that the Torah lists these four species that only have one simen, and they've never since found another species that has only one simen, so therefore that proves the truth of the Torah. It's a strong argument, but on the other hand, there have been various, for example, people bring up a llama and other such species over there that seem to contradict that, so it's not necessarily an ironclad thing. It's good for H seminars, it's not necessarily, yeah. Okay, anyway.
How do you know
if you'd be Jewish? Okay, honored. Yeah. That's the point, because in other words, depending on how narrowly or how widely you define a species, you could say that there are other ones. For example, it's true, you have llamas that also chew their cud the same way as camels do, but they don't have split hooves. They have their feet basically are similar to camels. If you think of a llama and a camel, a separate species, then that goes against what we're saying in the Gemara over here. On the other hand, you could argue back that a llama and a camel are basically different variants of the same species. Okay. Anyway, onward. V'omer of Chisda. We don't eat chazir because the Torah tells us we don't eat it. Here. Well, the Torah mentions that it has one of the simonim, and yet it's not kosher, right? V'omer of Chisda. Also, of Chisda says a similar din. What if the other way around? You're walking on the road. You find an animal that has its mouth chopped up. So you can't tell whether it has. You can't tell whether it chews its cud and whether it has these upper front teeth. Boidis papausi seh. Do the other way around. Check its hooves. See if they're split. Im pausi seh suzuka. If you find that its hooves are split, be a duashi fully split. That is the way kosher animals are supposed to be. Be a duashi tahara. Automatically, you know that it's tahar. Im lav be a duashi tmei. If not, then you know it's tamei. And again, with one exception, it will vadshi yakel chazir. As long as you can recognize that this mystery animal is not a chazir. Because a chazir, again, it has split hooves, doesn't chew its cud. So if this animal is a chazir, it's not going to be kosher, but otherwise it is. Well, okay, I don't know what you mean by tricky. You have a famous thing that sticks out its hooves and pretends to be kosher, but that's a drosha. The fact that we don't eat chazir because it says so in the Torah. Why does the Torah tell us? That's another question. But okay, again,
it's missing simanim.
That's the point. It only has one thing.
So why does the Torah have to tell us?
That's the point. So one second. Lav amrit ikachazir. So you're telling me that there is the one exception, that chazir has split hooves and doesn't chew its cud. Ikanami midachrin to domyel chazir. Don't you have the problem then that hypothetically this animal that you found with a cut up mouth might be some other species that is like the chazir in having split hooves and not chewing its cud? And again, the answer is loisakudaitach. You can't think that way. Again, the Tonid Vei Rabbi Shmuel and the Braita of Rabbi Shmuel, they learned, on the Pasuk says, why does it specifically say who? Again, same thing. Shalit by Lama, Hashem who rules his world, Yedea. He knows that there's no other creature that has split hooves and doesn't chew its cud, and therefore is Tomei, only the Chazir. Lefichach bar by a cult of who. Therefore, the cult specifies the word who to imply that that is the only exception. So again, so therefore, that's the point. So as long as you know that this mystery animal here is not a Chazir, then you're good. Okay. V'amr of Chitza. Then Rav Chitza says another din. By the way, there is in that connection. Speaking of animals that they found in the New World, eventually there's an animal that lives in South America, native to South America, called a tapir, caper. I don't know how it's pronounced. Whatever. Anyway, T A P I R. It also is similar to it's similar to a chazir. Yeah, it's similar to a chazir in having split hooves and not chewing its cud. So again, one possibility is it can be considered a variety of chazir. The Malbim on the Pesukim over there brings up a possibility. There's also in Chumash Devarim, in Parashas Re'eh, when it repeats the non-kosher animals, it mentions another type of animal. It mentions a creature called a shesua. We're going to deal with it later on in our Gemara, that a shesua, the Gemara mentions it's a creature that has two backs. So one possibility is the Gemara means Siamese twins. If you have animals that are born as Siamese twins, then we're saying they're not kosher. But the Malbim brings up a possibility also. This creature, the tapir, has a deep groove that runs down its back. So therefore, in a certain sense, it looks like it has two backs. And therefore, that might be what the pasuk is referring to as the shesua. Okay.
But it's from
It's from America. Okay, again, Shalit by Lama. Hashem created South America and its animals as well. So
we said the Lama is...
Okay, again, the one possibility is there's different ways of explaining, but I'm telling you what the Malbim is saying. Okay.
He
no, he probably saw them in Jews. I don't know. Okay. But Amr, of course they had Jews. The Malbim lived in the 1800s. Of course they had Jews.
Oh, the 1800s.
Okay. But Amr of Chitza, also of Chitza said, here's another Jew. Suppose a person is going in the desert. Now you find an animal where both things are missing. The mouth is chopped up. The legs are chopped up, so you can't tell if it chews its cud or it has split hooves. What are you going to do? Yeah, well, it might be misokenis, but okay, so you checked it in time. Okay, fine. Then what you can do is you check its flesh, you check its muscles. In mahalach shesi ve'edev, if you see that the muscles run shesi ve'edev, they run like they run vertically and horizontally. Biyaduashi, the fibers of them. Biyaduashi tahara, then you know the animal is tahar. Vimlav biyaduashi tmeya. If not, then you know the animal is tamei. Ovilvad shiyaki aroid. As long as you can recognize that this creature is not an aroid, which is a wild donkey. Because a wild donkey also has that.
Has what? Has muscles.
Has these muscles that run in horizontally and vertically. Yeah. So the question is, again, lav amet ika aroid. Okay, so you're telling me that there's an exception, that there's a wild donkey. Ika nami midachun de damila aroid. Isn't there the possibility that maybe this animal is some other non-kosher species?
Right.
The answer is gmitad de lesa. Okay, we have the Kabbalah from our Rebbeim that there's no other such animal. Now, the heichavot, that has this kind of arrangement of the muscles. The heichavot, right. The heichavot, where specifically are you supposed to check these muscles and see if they run vertically and horizontally? Bottom means flesh. So yeah, most of the meat of an animal is in its muscles. So where do you check? Amar Abaya, the tamer of Chistes, Abaya, or some say of Chistes says, "Bekan teha oikis." Specifically, you have to check under the tail. The muscles in that area, the muscles of the rump of the animal. In kosher animals, you have one on top of the other layers of muscle that run vertically and horizontally.
On the tail?
Under the tail. In the area under the tail. The rump of the animal.
There's line?
In general, when you eat a piece of meat, when you eat meat on Shabbos, mostly the meat you're eating is usually the meat you're eating from an the meat you eat, the brisket or whatever you eat on Shabbos, is usually taken from the muscles of the animal, someplace from the muscles of the animal, unless you're eating liver or something like that. If you look, you can see it has fibers in it, right? It's easier to cut it. You can see it's easier to cut in one direction than the other, right? It has like lines in it that run in one direction. Those are fibers. That's the muscle fibers. Muscle is made up of fibers. So in the case of a kosher animal, when the meat is well cooked, it falls apart like that, and you're like swings, sort of like swings, sort of, yeah. Okay, anyway, the point is that the meat is made up of such swings. Anyway, the point is that in kosher animals and also in the aroid, you have in that area near the tail, you have fibers of muscles that run vertically and ones that run horizontally. as opposed to in non-kosher animals, other than the arod, you don't have that. So therefore, this mystery animal over here, you checked it, and then you check that area and see if it has that, and you know it's not an arod, then you're good.
Hold on.
You found the animal alive over here. You checked it. If it wasn't alive, we're not going to talk about it. It's Nevela anyway. You found the animal alive. You checked it, and now you want to know, can I eat it? But now you checked it. Okay, let's continue. The Mishnah said Simone Chaya.
So that's if you're exhausted all the
other. If the other, because you're right, if you don't have a, you can't check the mouth and you can't check the feet because they've both been damaged, then you. Okay. I don't think Mashgiach enough to deal with this kind of thing. I don't know.
As I told him to come, I texted him to come. He has to know it.
Okay. I mean, I don't.
I don't want him to serve by a chassam and not kosher meat.
Okay, I don't think these particular dinim are going to be particularly relevant on a day-to-day basis for a Mashgiach. I suppose they might be more useful if you're ever leading a safari in Africa, then it might be more practical. That's a whole nother matter. Here we're not talking about Fine. We're not dealing with that. Once you find it's a kosher animal, sure, you're gonna have to remove the gidon nasha and the chaylev and drain the blood, etc. We're not dealing with that point. Okay.
Oh, now, one thing.
Yeah.
The one case is the delivery of the liver.
Mm-hmm.
It's white.
Okay.
And I also work with not kosher liver. I look the same as that.
I have no idea what.
It was coming out.
Okay. I don't know.
Anyway,
let's go on. Okay, we said in the Mishnah Simone Chaya. We said in the Mishnah Simone Behema Bechaya. Now, why do we need Simonim of a Chaya?
We don't need Chaya.
Well, no. We, of course, there are kosher Chayas that we can eat. Deer, gazelle, possibly giraffe. Well, we'll talk about it. Okay. So, the Gemara starts off. Turn it up on them. We learn in a Braisa. Elu Hein Simone Chaya. The following are the Simonim of a Chaya. So the Gemara interjects, that's kosher. So the Gemara interjects, wait a minute, what do you mean, simonim of a chaya? Chaya b'chol behema hilo simonim. The same simonim that we said, chew is cut and have split hooves, that apply to domestic animals, cows, sheep, and goats, the same ones are by a chaya. Why does the Braisa need to tell us separate simonim for a chaya? Amr Abzera, lahatu chelba. Right, but the nafkamina to know whether it's a behema or a chaya is, you know it's a kosher animal, but now you want to know, is it a kosher behema or chaya, because that makes a difference whether you can eat the chaylev of it. The chaylev of a domestic animal, a cow or sheep or goat is osur. The chaylev of a wild animal is mutter. So you need to know, is this a cow or is this a deer? Yeah, the Torah says, kol chaylev shor v'tetev v'ez lo say chaylev, you know, like the chaylev of those three species, and fine, that you're allowed to eat the chaylev of a chaya. Yeah.
Okay.
So the hachikama, so therefore now let's return to the Braisa. So the Braisa is saying as follows, Elohim simone chaya shechel b'mutter, so what are the simonim to know whether this is behema or chaya, and therefore to know whether it's chaylev is mutter to eat? So like this, kol sheyesh la karnayim utlafayim. If the animal has horns and tlafayim. Now, tlafayim on the face of it means hooves, but we already established that all kosher animals have hooves. So Tosfos talks about the ins and outs of the possibility that tlafayim means hooves that are shaped differently than domestic animals. Like this, many domestic animals have, the kosher ones, that is, have fairly rounded hooves. Like this is what the hooves of a cow look like, for example. So it's fairly rounded. As opposed to many of the wild kosher animals, like deer or whatever, have hooves that are much more pointed.
They run much more.
Well, maybe because they run much more, whatever it is. So therefore, tlafayim.
Why they're not called feet? They're not feet. They're hooves.
They're hooves.
They're harder.
Okay, so hooves are like nails. You have to realize.
An animal doesn't have a foot.
Okay, so here's the thing. Okay, let me explain. We human beings, and many types of animals, walk on the palms of our hands and the sole. Well, we don't walk on the palm of our hands, but whatever. We walk on the soles of our feet, and the four-legged equivalents also walk on the palms of their hands. Cats, for example, bears, dogs, etc., they walk like this, in other words. Then you have creatures that walk on their fingers, kind of. That's, for example, camels. The reason why a camel's foot is split but not all the way through is because it's the equivalent of, like, it's walking on its toes it's walking on its toes rather than on its tiptoes. So therefore, it's split in the front. No, a camel. So a camel's feet, therefore, split in the front, but not split in the back.
No, feet, they're hooves.
It has hooves, but the hooves don't cover the entire surface that walks on the ground. They're more like fingernails. No, they're never talking about. A camel has two toes.
Picture of a camel?
Let me see.
The only ones that have teeth is humans.
No. First of all, no, definitely not. Again, for example, cats and whatever also, cats also walk on here. I don't know if I have a good picture of it over here, but whatever. The point is, a camel's foot. I'll see if I can find one. But a camel's foot has hooves, has a sort of hoof on the front of it, but really those hooves are more like fingernails because of a camel. Again, with a camel, what it is, it's like it's walking on two fingers of each hand. I could probably find a picture, yeah. Let's see if I can find a picture. As opposed to kosher animals, okay, here's an example. So you can see it's split in the front,
mm-hmm.
but it's not split in the back.
Oh, we just see the front. Can I just zoom in?
Yeah.
The Torah says that
it's not kosher because it has to be.
The Torah says a camel is mafresis parsa.
So the Torah says that a camel is mafresis parsa, but it's not maligera. Mafresis parsa in the sense it has a split in the front and it has a hoof, an individual hoof on each of the two split parts, but it's connected in the back.
It's
like two fingers.
But is it a problem of gomel because it's not shaped?
Because not split all the way through.
That's the problem of gomel. It also chews its cud?
It also chews its cud, yes. Yeah, that's what we're saying. Okay, so now with kosher animals, what it is they actually walk on tiptoe.
So
we just said a camel is not really walking on tiptoe. A camel is walking on its fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Kosher animals walk on their tiptoes. Mm-hmm. The hoof is like a nail, but it surrounds the whole part that touches the ground, as opposed to the camel, which is kind of in front over there. So the difference is that you have with some kinds of animals like cows, it's more rounded, and with others like deer, it's more pointed.
Split hooves.
No,
they walk.
Right. Well, the fact that they have split hooves actually is based on how they walk differently. Right. Okay. Anyway, the point is if an animal has karnayim or tlapayim, if it has horns and hooves, which we're going to discuss soon, what kind of horns and what kind of hooves, then we know it's a wild animal. Tlapayim, we just said, means hooves, and Tosfos points out it may mean like more pointed hooves. Okay. Rav Doisa says, yesh l'karnayim, if the creature has horns, iyatatzorich, locks it off tlapayim, then you actually don't have to look to see if it has tlapayim, because automatically you know it's a chaya. Yesh l'tlapayim, on the other hand, if it has pointed hooves, tzorich hasa l'locks it off tlapayim, you still have to check to know whether it's a chaya, whether it has horns or not. And the Braisa finishes off. Then we'll see, one second. The Keresh, and the Braisa continues, what about a creature called the Keresh? Even though it only has one horn, mutter, such a creature is mutter. It chews its cud, it has split hooves, and it has only one horn. It's considered a chaya. And therefore, it's considered a chaya, and you would be allowed to eat its chaper.
A unicorn?
It could be a unicorn, although a unicorn is a mythical creature. So either it means some kind of creature that existed in those days and maybe nowadays is extinct. And Sichas Cholim discusses over here with this and also with a piece that we have later down on the Amud that maybe it's talking about a giraffe. A giraffe has like a little bump in the middle of its forehead that sort of resembles a horn. Sometimes it has two bumps further back, but it has in particular, it often has one bump in the front that resembles a horn. So the Gemara asks, okay, so you're telling me that if the creature has karnayim and tlapayim, horns and pointed hooves, then you know it's a chayim. The Gemara says, klalahu, is that a general rule? There are lots of exceptions. Varei eiz the yeshle karnayim with tlapayim. What about a goat has horns and it has pointed hooves? The chelbay also, and its chelav is still also. So you can't say a general rule. No, it's kosher, but its chelav is also because it's a domestic animal. The answer is kruchos, and it's not just that it has to have horns. The horns have to be kruchos. What are kruchos? Rashi explains that kruchos means like this. You have certain kinds of animals where their horns are, well, okay, so they, okay, first of all, we have to realize like this. When we talk about animals' horns, you have to distinguish between two basic types. You have the kind of horn which it has a core of bone, and then it has keratin on the outside of that. Those are the kinds that we make a shofar out of. The horn of a ram, for example, is made like that. The horn of a cow is also, but you can't use it for a shofar for a different reason. It's physically, it has the same characteristics, but it's possible for a shofar for other reasons. But anyway, the point is that's one kind of horn. And then you have the kind of horn which is all bone, like the antlers of a deer. So what we're saying over here is, in order for the horn to be a simon, that it's a higher kruchos bein, and they have to be kruchos. So Rashi explains that kruchos means they're made of many layers, one on top of the other. So a cow's horns are like that, for example, and the Gemara is going to ask that in a second. But the point is, in other words, you have, like, there'll be one layer of horn, another layer on top of it, like it grows a new layer every year or something. Yeah, you can see a cross-section of it over here. Like, by a goat, it's not like that. By a goat, it's more one solid piece.
And an antler also?
Is there an antler also? There's one solid. So that's one possibility what kruchos means.
We haven't yet finished.
But that's Rashi's definition of kruchos. You have another explanation of kruchos. It means that they're rounded. In other words, they're rounded in cross section. You have certain kinds of creatures whose horns are more like flat or teardrop shaped or whatever in cross section. Kruchos would mean they're round. Okay, the question is, okay, but how does that work then? When it comes to an ox, its horns are kruchos, according to either of these definitions, and an ox is a domestic animal, and then it's chayla b'zol. Either it's made of layers or it's round.
Or it's round.
Yeah. The answer is charukos, Ben. And the answer is, the Gemara answers, the horns have to be charukos. Charukos, Rashi explains, means that they're full of grooves. So the horns of a cow or an ox are not like that. So the question is... So the question is, then we're back to, in that case, a goat has horns that are charukos, that have grooves in them, and it's still osir. Rashi is explaining that the Gemara assumed at this point that once we say charukos, we're taking back the thing of kruchos. We're saying it doesn't need to be kruchos. As long as it's charukos, then we're good. So therefore we're back to the question about the goat. Tosfos explains differently. The Gemara knew that we still have the rule of kruchos, but the Gemara is asking. There's a certain type of goat that the Gemara is going to talk about soon, called an izakarkos, that has both of those simonim, and yet we have a suffix whether it's a behema or a chaya. So it can't just be. In other words, so according to Rashi, the question is just charukos by itself is clearly not enough. Otherwise, it would include a goat. And according to Rivam, it means that even kruchos and charukos are still not enough, because the fact is we have a suffix on an animal that has those. The answer is mufutsolos b'inan. So the answer is the horns have to be mufutsolos. What is in order for it to be a chaya? Mufutsolos, Rashi explains, means branched, like antlers. Tosfos discusses that maybe the word is not mufutsolos, but rather mufutsolos, meaning bent over at the tip. So the question is, okay, but what about a deer? What about a tzvi? Does not have branched horns. The chelbim mutter, and yet we know it's chelb is mutter. Rashi says, now we usually translate a tzvi as a deer. So Rashi says, obviously that can't be. A deer has branched antlers. Yeah. So therefore, Rashi says, obviously what it means is our translation of tzvi must be a mistake. Really, Rashi says a tzvi must be what Rashi calls it a steinbok, which is like a mountain goat or something like that. There's a creature that lives in South Africa that's called a steinbok or something like that. So it could be what Rashi is referring to. But there's another possibility mentioned in Tichas Kolin that maybe Rashi is referring to a creature that's called in English an ibex.
Show us. Don't they knew different animals in different places?
Yes. So Rashi is saying that a tzvi is this, where indeed the horns are not branched. He mentions over here in Sifas Kolon that maybe what Rashi is referring to over here, not an ibex, sorry, is a gazelle, which is a creature that lives in Eretz Yisrael in that area, and also its horns aren't branched. So maybe that's what the Gemara is implying that a Tzvi is. Anyway, Tosfos disagrees with Rashi on that, on various grounds. Tosfos argues that Tzvi is in fact a deer, and that's why Tosfos says that the word is not mifutzalos, branched, but rather mifutzalos, bent over at the tips. So a deer doesn't have its antlers, are not bent down at the tips. So therefore, the Gemara is asking, if he's telling me that it needs to be mifutzalos and mifutzalos, then it would mean a deer wouldn't fit in that, and yet we know a deer is chelav as mutter. The answer is chaduros, for Enam. The answer is we have another criteria. It has to be that the horns are chaduros. So what are chaduros? So Rashi says that chaduros means rounded. Unlike, for example, a deer's horns, which are more flattened. So according to Rashi, the definitions we have so far are as follows. We said that you need, we said kruchos means that they're made of layers. Charukos means they have grooves in them. Mefutsolos means they're branched. And now we're saying chaduros, meaning that they're rounded. Then Rashi brings another explanation that chaduros means that kruchos means rounded. Not made out of layers, but rather that kruchos means rounded. Charukos would be the same as we said before, with grooves in them. Mefutsolos would be the same as we said before, branched. And this last one that we're mentioning, chaduros, Rashi says, means that they're pointy at the top, as opposed to the horns of certain animals that are not so pointy at the top. They're more rounded. Okay. So those are the criteria. So the Gemara says, okay, so like this, Hilkach. So the bottom line is as follows.
The Torah doesn't mention.
These things. The Chachamim have them a Kabbalah, or the Chachamim figured them out. Okay. Hilkach. So here's the bottom line to figure out whether the creature is a behemoth or a chayav. Hecha de miftala, if the horns are miftala, which means according to Rashi, branched, and according to Tosfos that they bend down at the tips, loy din of loy dayana, then there's no din, no dayan. In other words, you don't even have to second guess it anymore. Automatically, you know it's a chayav. And by the way, automatically, you know it's a chayav. If the horns are branched, or according to Rashi, or they bend down at the tips, like Tosfos, then you know automatically it's a chayav. No further questions asked. Then you can eat the chayav of it. Well, and by the way, Tosfos points out, we're talking over here specifically within kosher animals because there are non-kosher animals don't have horns. You have a rhinoceros, for example, but rhinoceroses do, but their horn is on their nose. Not we're talking about horns on the head. There's no non-kosher species that has horns on its head.
What about a moose?
A moose is a type of deer. It's also kosher.
A moose is kosher.
Yeah. Okay, so wait. With caveats that we'll talk about in a second. Okay, wait. Okay, so first of all, so again, if the horns are miftala, branched according to Rashi, or bent down at the tips according to Tosfos, lojina v'lojayana, then there's nothing to talk about. You know right away it's a chaya, and you can eat the chayla. Hecha delay miftala, and if the horns are not branched or bent downward, then you need three things. But in kruchos, chaduros, vacharuchos, you need all of the other three criteria that we mentioned before. Rounded, made of layers, pointed out in cross-section. Chaduros, rounded in cross-section. The charuchos, and that they have grooves, or pointed out second explanation. Grooves means like lines in them, indentations, yeah. Like carvings along the surface, but yeah.
That's a groove.
So again, according to Rashi's first explanation, that's what it is. According to Rashi's second explanation, kruchos means they're round, chaduros means they're pointed at the tips, and charukos again means... Okay, come on, we're learning now, it's not famous. And charukos again would mean that they have grooves, and v'hud mivrachir kaihu. Also, it's not just that they have to have grooves, the grooves have to run into each other. They have to have that the grooves are not run into each other. Mivlachir kai means that the grooves are actually embedded. No, that they're actually below the surface. That they're not just on the surface.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You have two different explanations. Rashi says that it means they're tkufos or smuchun with loins ebezeb, that they're very close to each other and one of them runs into the other. And Tosfos says that maybe what it means is that they're deeply indented. Okay, anyway, the point is, it's because of that last point that we have a suffix on the izakarkoi. there is a character, is a some type of creature, where we have a suffix, whether it is a behemoth or a chaya. So one possibility, we don't know, I don't know what it is in modern terms, but whatever it is, the point is, it has horns that are chaburais and charukais. The problem is, the Rashi says, the problem is, on the other hand, so it seems to have all the simonim of chaya. On the other hand, it's called izakarkas, it's called a goat. So therefore, maybe it's actually a type of goat, in which case it would be a behemoth. So that's one explanation. There's a number of other explanations that are shown in what exactly the suffix is on an izakarkas. Maybe that it has grooves, but they don't clearly run into each other. Whatever, a few possibilities. So because of that, you have a suffix, whether the chaylev of it is mutter.
They live in Eretz
Yisrael? I don't know. They live someplace. Okay, so the Gemara tells the case. If the behemoth, it's also right. So, because the Torah tells us that, I don't know. Yeah, there's a question. But that's just the reason is because the chaylev of a behemoth, when it's brought as a korban, is offered on the mizbeach, where the chaya can't be brought as a korban. Okay. So the Gemara tells the case. We can't eat it, right? Hahi is a character that have a davoy bei resh kolosa. There was once one of these creatures, an is a character that was in the household of the resh kolosa, and they shechted it. The akur maloy, a goat of karkos. Or kraken, there's a couple of different gears, so whatever. It's some kind of animal, whether it's a suffix, whether it's a behemoth or a chaya, based on what we just said, based on the simonim of the horns. So it's in the household of the Resh Kolosa. The Oku Maloit, son of the Targumina, they took out a basketful of chaylev from it. And the question is, can you eat it or not? Rav Achoy also, so Rav Achoy held its author. Rav Achoy held its author because he said it might be a behemoth, you can't eat it. Rav Shmuel b'reid Rav Abahu achamine. Whereas Rav Shmuel b'reid Rav Abahu ate from that fat. He not only held his mutter, he actually ate from it because he held his mutter. Tori anapshe and Rav Shmuel b'reid Rav Abahu. By the way, the Rav Shura Goyen mentions in his Igeres on Jewish history, he mentions that these two, Rav Achoy and Rav Shmuel b'reid Rav Abahu, are from among the Rabbanon Tzvoroi. They're from the early Rabbanon Tzvoroi. They're like from the generation after Ravina and Rav Ashi. Yeah.
Anyway,
so I guess he had it. Kori Anapshe and Shmuel Ben Rababo said on himself, I can apply to myself the pasuk in Mishlei Mitri Piish Kisba Bitnai. From the fruits of a person's mouth, his stomach can be filled up. In other words, because I have the Kabbalah that this animal is a chaya, therefore I'm able to enjoy eating the fat of it, where if I hadn't learned that, I wouldn't be able to. Yeah. Who is the halacha like? Shochel mitam. So they sent a message from there, meaning from Eretz Yisrael. Hilchsa kavasei the Shmuel b'reid Rav Abahu. Mitam means literally from there. It's like mehosam, from there. Hilchsa kavasei the Shmuel b'reid Rav Abahu. The halacha is indeed like a Shmuel b'reid Rav Abahu. Technically, that fat is mutter. The Isaac character is considered a chai, in other words. But be careful with the covered of Rabbeinu Achoy to not be masculine in his presence, because he enlightens the eyes of everybody in Golos, being such a great Talmud Chacham. So in other words, go ahead, you can fast in like a Shmuel Barababo and eat the fat and then eat the chaylev from such a creature, but don't do it in front of Rav Achoy because it would be disrespectful to him, and he's a great Talmud Chacham.
Why we don't?
Because we don't have, because that's the practice. It's mutter, but still respect of Achoy's opinion in his presence. Lamaita, we don't know what an Izakarkas is, so it doesn't really help us much. By the way, an interesting point. The Shach in Shulchan Aruch, in these dinim about Simonim of Behemoth and Chayas, the Shach has an expression over there because we're not sure of what we just discussed over here, of the definitions of these various criteria that Gemara mentioned. Therefore, a chaya should be eaten. Therefore, you need a masoras on a chaya. Now, what does the shach mean by that? So a number of the achronim, shortly after the shach, for example, the prima godim, say, obviously the shach's not talking about whether you can eat the animal b'chlal. As long as that is true, it's cut, it has split homes. There's no question it's kosher. The question is about the chaylev. Given that we're saying we're not sure, so only if you have a masoras, that's a wild animal, can you eat the chaylev. On the other hand, you have achronim who learn the shach to be saying that with a chaya, you actually need to have a masoda in order to be able to eat it b'chal. You can't just rely on chewing it cut and have split hooves, but whether you can eat it or not. This came up as a major issue in Israel. This came
Torah.
It's not adding to the Torah. The Torah tells us that it has to chew its cut and have split hooves, but because we can't always be sure, you can't always be sure what's considered chewing its cut, what's considered fully split hooves or whatever, therefore we should be machmer and only eat if we have a clear masoda on the thing. So it happened about 70 years ago that this came up as an issue in Israel. They wanted, they needed meat in the country. There weren't a lot of animals available. So they wanted to import zebu cattle, which are, they're a subspecies of cattle, not from Africa, from India, actually. They're a little different than regular cattle. In particular, they have a big hump of fat. behind their shoulders. The question was, are they kosher or not? They're chaya. They're not a behemoth. They're not domesticated. So, in fact, the Chazon Ish at that time held very strongly that you can't do that. You can't. He understood the shach to be saying you need a masoda to be able to
but
eat a chaya at all.
How did he know it was a chaya?
Because it's nice. It's not a domesticated animal. So, nobody actually domesticated. It lived out in the wild. Nobody actually, it's not a cow, a sheep, or a goat. Let's put it that way. It doesn't live with people. So therefore, he held very strongly that you can't do that. You can't, you can't eat from it unless you have a masorah on it, and there's no masorah on it, so therefore you can't. And it came up an issue here and there over the years because actually they have bred these with other cattle, and there is sometimes, well, there may be that. But on the other hand, they've brought a certain amount of that meat into Eretz Yisrael over the years, and then the question has become, is it allowed based on what he's saying over there that maybe you need a masorah? So that's a bit of an unsettled question. So I don't know what the conclusion is.
You don't have a masorah, but you know that...
Okay, again, cows, sheep, and goats, you don't have a masorah because it's clear what cows are, it's clear what sheep are, it's clear what goats are. But the shach is saying that for a chaya, you need a masorah. So again, does the shach mean that you need a masorah in order to be able to eat its chaylev, but in order to eat it, the chal, in order to eat its meat, all you need is that it chews its cud and have slivers? Or does he mean that even to eat it, you need a masorah? So I'm telling you that the reason would be because the fact is you have a lot of creatures out there, and you have a lot of creatures out there. The Torah mentions seven specific species that are t'chayas t'hardas, ayol t'zviva yachmer. We don't know to identify them. We don't know those. We don't know exactly. We just saw that Rashi and Tosfos, for example, argue with al-kosher. Yeah, they're kosher chayas. But what is an ayol? What is a tzvi? We just saw that Rashi and Tosfos argue what a tzvi is. So therefore, it's not so, therefore, you can't be so certain. When you find an animal, it chews its cud and has split hooves. But is it one of those seven types of chayas? Maybe, maybe not. So therefore, there's an argument to be made that you need a masorah.
Yeah, so my question is whether we rely on a strict simanim of the Torah or not.
So that's the question. Given that the Torah not only tells us simanim, but also lists the names of the kosher animals and lists these seven, then that implies only these seven. So in that case, if you find an animal and you don't know whether it's one of these seven, not necessarily can you eat it. So that's one argument to be made based on what the Shach is saying. Okay.
Yeah.